The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Amanda Larkin told me about her mission to find 796 baby dolls and display them in memory of the babies that died in the mother and baby home in Tuam. Jen Gannon talked to me about the struggle facing single people when it comes to trying to buy a home of their own. Ken Healy spoke to me on International Nurses Day to pay tribute to his late mother, Betty, who was awarded the Florence Nightingale Medal for nursing by the International Red Cross in 1968. And Miles Dungan told me about taking a deep dive into his family history for his new book, which explores four murders that took place during the Irish Revolution. That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you enjoy. At 9:28, Amanda Larkin, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ryan. Happy Monday.
And the same to you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, thank you. You?
Good, thank you. You're on a mission, aren't you?
We are definitely on a mission.
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning then. You want to collect 796 dolls for a very profound reason. Tell me about that.
That's correct, Ryan. So we're doing a little doll of love. So we're looking to collect 796 dolls, and what we want to do is we want to do an image that represents the 796 babies missing in Tuam, believed to be in the septic tank.
Okay, and tell me about the image you're trying to create and how you're going to do it.
So the image we're trying to create, what we want to do is we have a location selected in Mayo. Mm-hmm. And we just want to lay the dolls out very, very simply, just 796, just to show the image of the amount of babies we're talking about.
This might sound like an odd question, but is there a particular type of doll you want?
So there is.
Yeah.
So what we'd be hoping for would be a baby born doll, Ryan.
I understand the one you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, so the ones that are baby size, I suppose.
Mm. That is a very striking image, isn't it? If you get 796 dolls, like almost a real life childlike size dolls in a field. Mm-hmm. Before we get to the whys and the wheres of it, how are you going to achieve this in terms of collecting the dolls and getting them? And what are you looking for today?
Oh, so what we're looking for today is dolls. We're looking for dolls to come in. We have collection points set up ourselves. There's a team of four of us that are running this.
Okay.
So there are four women running this. So at the moment, we have about 350 dolls in at the moment, Ryan. So we're still looking for more dolls to come in. They're coming in from all over Ireland to us at the moment, Ryan. They're coming in from England. They're coming. We have people contacting us who wishes to buy dolls and have them delivered to us. So today we're just looking for more support. We're just looking for more dolls. If people wish to do collection points or if people can bring dolls from all over Ireland to us, whatever help is out there, we'll take it.
Okay.
No matter how small or no matter if people can't help with getting a doll, with transport, you know, share it on Facebook, tell a friend.
Okay, you're just shy of about 400 dolls now to complete your project. And for example, Catherine Corliss, this is really the person who brought this story to the world. Is she volunteered to help out in any way?
Absolutely. So Catherine has actually made dolls from scratch for us, Ryan.
Oh.
So Catherine has made dolls. She's made about, I think, 15 dolls from scratch for us for this display.
Out of what?
So out of the faces, I know that she's made them out of clay and stuff like that. We have it on our event page. We have an event page, Little Doll of Love.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the photos, some of the photos up there of the dolls that have come in so far and different things like that. So we're trying to track it because almost every doll that comes in, Ryan, there's a story behind it or there's a reason that somebody has put the doll in. And we could write a book at this stage about the 350 dolls that have come in so far.
Oh, I bet. And when you have the 796 dolls, you're going to a field in, is it Castlebar, somewhere near there?
We're going to a selected area in Castlebar. That's right, yeah.
And you'll place them in a row, or have you planned that out yet?
Yeah, we have. We have plans made, but everything is subject to change on the day, Ryan, how it'll look and stuff. But we do have an idea in our head, but we think we'll get a selection of images from that. Because of COVID and restrictions, we don't want to organise anything in case the restrictions have changed. So we've done it to level five, there's 10 of us there on the day, and it'll be put out on social media, the video and the images afterwards.
What do you want people to take from the visual of these nearly 800 dolls on a field?
The amount, Ryan.
Yeah.
The amount. 796 is a number that rolls off people's tongue too easily. Each one of these are babies. Each one of these are innocent little souls that didn't get a voice, Ryan. A lot of people have said to me in the past few years, because I have been involved with the events that go on in June almost every year, and every time I do something, I want to do, if we're doing something, like 3 years ago, we did little lilies to represent each baby, and people said to me, you're not going to do 796 of them, are you? You're mad. And I said, of course I'm going to do 796. And they said, just do a couple of hundred. Nobody will know the difference. But there is 796 bodies missing, believed to be in the septic tank in June. They didn't get a voice, so we're going to give each one of those, you know, their own voice or their own image or their own way to be recognised. You know, I don't think it has hit home, certainly in the government or for ministers, that there's 796 bodies. And I think when you see 796 dolls, when you see 796 of anything, you know, the volume that's there really, really comes to light. And again, Ryan, there's 9,000 missing babies in Ireland. Somebody said to me, what will you do if you get over 796 dolls? I said, if we get 9,000 dolls, we'll display the 9,000 missing babies of Ireland.
Let's stick with the tomb story for now, Amanda. And would you tell me about Carmel?
My mama?
Yeah.
Yeah, so my mum was born in the tomb mother and baby home in 1949. And she spent 5.5 of her years in the tomb mother and baby home before she was boarded at to Mayo.
What did she, I mean, she's very young. Was she able to tell you anything about her experience in the home?
In the tomb mother and baby home, I suppose for a lot of survivors, she would have flashes. She would have certain images that she can remember or certain names that she would remember. But her memories would be more from when she came out of the home, the different things that she experienced, animals, people. That's what she would remember more than actual experiences of the mother and baby institution.
How long did it take for her to find out? In other words, what age was she when she found out who her mother was?
Mom was 70 years of age. We've only found out 18 months ago, Ryan, who Carmel's mother was.
And can you share any details with me?
Yeah, so Carmel's mother, from the information that we were given 18 months ago, she would have been 38 years old when she got pregnant. She would have been living with her mother in Ballina. Mm-hmm. So at 38, she was coerced into the tomb mother and baby home. She spent 9 months in there, and then she would have been trafficked from the tomb mother and baby home down to the psychiatric unit in Castlebar, which would have been the mental hospital at the time. She's believed to have spent 12 years of her life there, Ryan, and she passed away. And because there is no record of family contact or any contact with her for the 12 years, she was then buried in a mass grave in Castlebar.
God, it's like something out of the Dark Ages, isn't it? After all these years. And
I think for that, Ryan, the most hurtful thing for Mum, because I was with her when the social workers broke that news to her 18 months ago in Castlebar in the Tusla offices. And I think for Mum, for her, the biggest hurt and the biggest upset for her is that she will never know what her mother looked like. She will never have a photograph of her mother. She will never know what her own mother looked like.
Did she take any comfort, cold as it was, in finding any details at all, or was it too late, too little, too late?
she had struggled for so long to get the details. PISLA had closed her file, Ryan, with a couple of years that there was no information there. And then suddenly, out of the blue, this came. Mm. It was the manner in which it came, Ryan, that was just, it was so unbelievably hurtful at the time.
You know, I was watching Reeling in the Ears last week, and they were showing some of the women who had been in different homes coming out of the Dáil. I'd forgotten how emotional it was, how these people of a certain age who should have been given so much more respect and dignity, you know, just standing at the gate crying like children. And I suppose your mum is one of those women in some ways.
We're still standing at the gates and we're still begging like children. We're begging for 976 babies to be taken out of a septic tank in June. They're still begging for closure. That's what they're looking for, Ryan.
Well, tell me about that. The 796 babies, where are we on the exhumation? It feels like we've been talking about this for a long time. And I know Catherine Corliss always says, you know, look, it's great that we've heard this bit of good news today, but we still haven't got the proper answer. So where is it at?
So it's in the Oireachtas. So Catherine was in the Oireachtas a couple of weeks ago where the bill was being debated. I was in the Oireachtas a couple of weeks ago as a member of the collaborative forum where it's being debated. So it's with the Oireachtas at the moment. It has to come to the Dáil. We're hoping it'll come this month to the Dáil. And then it has to pass and be signed into legislation. So,
and is that for exhumation?
That's for the burials bill.
The burials bill, and that will allow for an exhuming of the bodies.
Yeah, excavation of the bodies, yeah.
And
but the earliest we'll be looking is next year, I think, if everything goes according to plan. Okay. But at the moment, we're experiencing delays even with the living witnesses redress. So
the fight goes on.
For the survivors, the delay was the commission's report. They waited and waited years and years for the commission report. So the delay that we're experiencing right now, we're unsure what's causing that delay.
Okay.
We're unsure.
Maybe somebody might explain that to us. Wouldn't that be handy?
It would be lovely to have some direct communication from the department, from the Mother and Baby Home Department. I asked for it last week, Ryan.
Yeah.
Just to explain to us why the delay is going on, just to have a little bit of respect for the living witnesses, for the survivors.
That wouldn't take much more than two paragraphs to say, listen, sorry about this, here's the following. This is what's happening. Which ministry does that fall under? Is it the
Minister O'Gorman?
So Minister for Children, Roderick O'Gorman. So he really needs to get his people on that to issue even a couple of paragraphs to say, look, we're out the door here, we're up to our ears, but we are close and we're, you know, something reassuring. Or at least
just updated.
Updated, okay, so that's what you need.
That's all we're asking for. That's Minister Sapone, really set the tone with us, nothing for us without us. That was the motto that was done. We're 2 weeks late, we've had no information from the government, and I suppose we thought last year when the burials bill was going through and stuff like that, oh my God, is this the last year we're doing a Vincent tomb? Is this the last year we have to remind the government we're here?
Mm.
And we're now looking at it going, oh my God, we're here again, and now we've to lay 796 dolls out to show the world, to show Ireland, this is the amount of babies that is believed to be lying there. This is the amount of Irish citizens who didn't get a voice, didn't get justice, didn't get anything.
When that picture comes out of the 796 dolls on a number of fields, whatever it might be, that picture will go around the world, and that picture will be shameful, and we have plenty to be ashamed of, let's face it. But that's the impact you hope to have, I presume, just to shame people into action.
It's a horrible thing, Ryan, but yeah, it's a horrible thing that we have to do that. It's a horrible thing that this amount of years on, after the story broke, after everything, that we're still in a position where we have to shame the Irish government into doing it. I mean, the Irish government is in power now over this current government over a year. I know with COVID, I know with restrictions, but none of the current government has stood in tune. Our Taoiseach, our Taoiseach, our minister, our president has not stood in the Sighting Tomb.
And again, you can certainly look at COVID for a lot of reasons out of that for the moment, but that's being lifted. So there'll probably be another day to answer those questions.
And they are more than welcome. Each one of them has been invited down personally by survivors, by living witnesses, to stand in tune.
Okay.
So they can explain to them and they can stand there and listen to the survivors.
Shall we talk about the dolls for a second? Because people are asking if they want to contribute a doll to the to the project that you're talking about. What's your Facebook or what's your detail?
So the event page on Facebook is A Little Doll of Love.
Okay.
If you go on that and you send us a message and you tell us where you are or where the dolls are, we will do our best to get a pickup. We have a couple of pickup points at the moment, Ryan. They are based in the west of Ireland. That's why if anybody is able to pick up point or something for us, we would be so grateful for any help that your listeners are willing to give us. We have an amazing man, John Buggy, who's willing to do a pickup for us at the Red Cow Hotel on the 12th of May between 8 and 9 p.m.
Okay.
He is Callum Transport. That's what's wrote on his van. C-A-L-L-U-M Transport. We have another drop area in Galway City at Terryland House. So it's just to the right of Terryland Fruit and Veg. There's a door there. There's a drop box inside. In Castlebar, at the NWSPCA in Linenhall Street, Castlebar, there's a collection point. Then we have.
If you put if they're all up on, if people go to a little doll of love, they'll find all that on that.
Amanda, all that information's there.
Amanda, it's an intriguing prospect and it's a dark story. There's no question about it. But good luck with it. Best to your mum and to everyone involved in the project. And hopefully, I'll see you in Tuam at some point, maybe even over the summer.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Yeah. Ryan, can I just say huge, huge thank you to everybody so far that has helped out.
Sure.
As I said, every doll that has come in, Ryan, there's a story behind it. We have the most beautiful stories. There is a lady in England who bought 5 dolls and had them delivered to Ireland because that's how she wants to contribute. There's other people who've gone into attics and they've taken out 40, 50-year-old dolls. They're antiques, Ryan.
Yeah.
And they want this doll to represent in the thing. So for everybody out there who's helped us so far, come on board, donate a doll, collect a doll for us. We are so, so grateful to those people.
Okay.
So, so grateful. And for any help that's out there and for you having us on this morning. It's such a huge boost to me and the team and everybody, the support that's out there.
All right. Well, keep doing what you're doing, Amanda. It's lovely to talk to you and I wish you well.
You too, Ryan.
All the best. Thank you.
Much.
Amanda Larkin joining us on the programme this morning. And just as she was saying there, if you want to get involved, go to their Facebook page, which is A Little Doll of Love or Little Dolls of Love. You'll get what you need there. It's nearly 9:45. Jen Gannon, good morning to you.
Hello.
You may prove the exception to the life is good rule today because I was reading your article in the journal.ie, reading elements of it out at the end of the programme yesterday, and we thought, actually, it's so good, we'd like to talk to you about it because it is a talking point. What is the story, Jen?
Oh, what is the story?
Where to begin? I mean, where to begin?
Exactly. I mean, I was even saying today there's this joke on dating apps like Tinder saying, do you want to go halves on a house? That's an icebreaker now. That's the way it's going.
And that's before you even say hello. I like that. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. We're talking houses. And do we need to know your credentials or do I sound like a bank looking for your mortgage details?
Oh, God. Do you want to go into that?
Yeah, I kind of do. I think it would put a great perspective on it for listeners.
Okay. Well, I'm single and I love advertising that I'm single now, call me, and I am a renter and I am a freelance journalist and I just feel that I am kind of being left behind by the housing market and I know that a lot of people are in the same boat as me. Now they may not be in the arts industry or sector, they may be professionals, but they also feel as a single person that the right to own a property in Ireland or even just to have stabilised rent is just something that is not happening for them.
Okay, age group ballpark.
Ballpark, oh, the wrong side of 30. So
all
let's
right.
say you're enough.
Early 30s, essentially. Okay.
No, mid Yeah. I feel like Ketja Fluan in The Housewives.
Yeah.
Around my age.
Exactly. And I could keep going until we get the actual, but we pinpoint exactly. So up until now, in terms of trying to get a house and get a mortgage, as a single person, did you ever come close to being in a relationship with somebody enough that you nearly got a house together, or talked about it?
There was talk about it, okay. And I think that is something when you're in a couple that it's just so much that conversation comes up a lot easier than it would when you're on your own and you're thinking, I just can't do this. It's actually impossible.
And talk to me about that impossibility.
I mean, even to be able to, you know, put together a 30,000 euro deposit, and you'd have to have a salary of over 70,000 to be able to try and do it. And I just think when you're renting and the rents are so exorbitant, it's very hard to try and just live your life and pay your rent, and at the same time, trying to save is just out of this world. It just doesn't feel like it's something that's possible for a lot of single people.
Before the pandemic, what was your house, your living arrangement?
Well, I mean, I live in an apartment by myself, but I did have roommates as well. And then they bought their own property, they're a couple, and they moved out. So I'm alone now. It's very precarious.
I understand that. Are you paying the same rent now on your own that you were paying when the three of you were there?
Yeah.
Oh, crikey. So that's put a massive hole in your finances, obviously.
Mm, and this is the thing, because, I mean, a lot of people that I know that are single and they're paying this exorbitant amount of rent out every month, there is no opportunity for them to actually think about. It's just the panic every month of just having to pay your rent and bills, and that's all you're thinking of. You're just thinking of from month to month, and there really is no long-term plan for anybody, like, put into place for anybody.
How common is it among the 30-somethings of modern Ireland to be in this zone?
I spoke to a friend of mine who is in a completely different industry. Like, she would be considered as a working professional and, you know, have a stable, good job, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
And she is facing the exact same fears and problems that I am having. And you're thinking, you know, to yourself, the older that you get, are you going to have to be living with other people when you're 40s and 50s and, you know, with strangers, with roommates? And it just doesn't seem like a viable situation. And it shouldn't have to be like that, you know, because you're spending thousands on rent a month and you can't get enough money together to put the deposit together. And it feels like single people have been left out of the housing conversation completely because there's such a concentration on just, and I know, don't get me wrong, it's very hard for couples themselves to buy properties in Ireland as well. I'm not saying that, but just as single people, you're never in the mix of the conversation at all, because it does feel like the government are, like, you know, an old your relative saying to you, would you not ever settle down, for God's sake? You know, you're just not in that conversation at all. It's not a permanent state.
Do you feel that the government is kind of saying, you know, don't be so silly trying to buy a place on your own, just find a nice fella or a girl or whatever you need and settle down together and sort that out?
Yeah, I do. I think there is this underlying conservatism in Irish society. I mean, we say that we're a modern society, but I do think there is this conservatism, this idea that the family is sacred and, you know, that you're some kind of overgrown teenager if you're not in a relationship, and that is just not a permanent state, that you will find someone. So I do think when it comes to wanting a place on your own, they just think it's laughable, that it's not something. We don't have that European sensibility where you see somewhere like in Berlin, they have a rent freeze, which is amazing, or, you know, just to help people out to not have to pay exorbitant rents or worry about the fact that they could be turfed out tomorrow because the rent is too high or somebody wants to turn, you know, the place into an Airbnb. And I think we need that respect. It's just that little bit of dignity that single people want. They want to be part of society. Like, I don't understand why it feels like there's this stigma. There's a stigma in Ireland about renting, first of all, because it's like the scramble to get on the property ladder, which I think is insane. And I think if they made rent stabilised, that would take away some of the pressure somewhat.
Do you think there's a stigma about renting?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think the older that you get, the more it's like, have you not tried to buy somewhere, or I'm getting a mortgage, or, you know, and that's where the conversation always goes, rather than I'm renting a place, or families renting places is very, you know, people don't talk about them a lot either. And I think I really just feel that if there was an open conversation about how to actually get the renting market sorted, then I would feel a lot better as well. Long-term renting, you know, people are like to me, would you not leave Dublin? And it's like, well, why should I leave my home? Like, why is that? It's something that I would have to do. I've lived here all my life. Like, it's not a possibility that I could actually, you know, not even buy a place, but rent a place and be there long-term.
But that's what the market is saying to you now, Jen. Mm. I mean, that is what the market is saying. Is that you say, but I want to live where I was brought up. I want to live where, you know, near my mother. I want to live, you know, near the sea or whatever it might be. And the market is saying, you can't afford it. You got to get out. Head down the coastline or head to the Midland, wherever you might be more affordable. But you're out. I mean, it's not a singles friendly world when it comes to so many things in this country, but particularly the property.
Yeah, and I also think like that also begs the question, what do we want from Dublin as a city? Like, do we want it just to become a place where tourists are and where people just go to Dublin to work and then go home? Like, that's not a community. That's not the Dublin I grew up in. That's not, you know, a society. And I just feel that that's a huge issue.
Do you think that there should be some class of allowance, if you like, for single people when it comes to buying a property, let alone renting one, that gives them a little leg up when competing against couples?
I mean, I just think that we need to have proper conversations. Like, we don't, I mean, if you heard Leo Varadkar before saying, just move back in with your parents and save up, like, sure, it's grand. You know, these are not sensible opinions. Like, we need, moving back in with your parents is not a viable option for a lot of people. I mean, we can't depend on that. That's such a weird thing to say. And I just think we need to have sensible conversations around what it is like, the truth of what it is like to be a single person in Ireland trying to, you know, maybe buy a property. But like, the first thing that needs to be done is we need to regularise rent so people can actually live and people can actually afford to save a bit and then get into that conversation, you know, about buying places as well.
Do you want to buy a place or are you happy to rent? Like, you know, the way people often say this, because I hear these debates all the time on the radio and they say, oh, well, in France and Paris, the culture is renting and that's what you rent till you die. But in Ireland, we seem to have this weird, psychodramatic relationship with the land since the famine,
yeah,
that
we want to own
a piece of
land.
Yeah, even if it's a yard and a bit of a washing line and half a tree, it's ours. I own it. You know, where are you in all of that?
I mean, eventually, like, but I would be happy to just have, you know, some kind of security that rent is going to be stabilised, first of all. So I think if you have that on a long-term plan of renting, that would be amazing. But I would, yeah, of course I would like to own somewhere, a small place. I'm not asking for a palace, like, but, you know, sometimes I feel that my future is going to be like the Golden Girls, like a Golden Girls older person commune, because that's what a lot of single Irish people are facing now. Now, the Golden Girls, amazing. In some ways I like that idea, but in other ways I'm like, it would be nice to be able to have somewhere for yourself.
Have you gone to a house viewing at all?
No, that just sounds absolutely a pie in the sky at this stage.
It's just, I believe they are among the most depressing ways to spend an afternoon, especially if you're not really in the running, because you see all the different types of people you're up against and there's a kind of hopelessness to it. And I also believe that on My Home or Daft or whatever, that people are nearly, if you're in the market, whether it's renting or buying, that you're standing with your phone and the app going, there's a new one in and it's gone. There's a new one in and it's gone. Like, it sounds to me so disheartening an experience. I actually can, I can sense from what you're saying today that it is just a hard slog.
It is a hard slog. And it's a hard slog, you know, not only when that's your future, as in you're going to be standing on a Saturday morning at 8 o'clock in the morning with a massive queue, you know, with people trying to buy the same property and vulture funds like sweeping in and you never had a chance in the first place. But it's also very disheartening for renters when you're looking up daft.ie and it looks like some kind of prison or somebody has made an outhouse from their shed and they're like, now you can live in there like a dog. Like, these are the things that need to be regulated too, like a converted space, or you have, you know, beds in your kitchen right beside the washing machine. How convenient is that? You're paying $1,400 a month for that. Thanks very much. And, you know, these are also the really depressing things that need to be talked about too and regulated and looked at.
Will I ask you the most annoying...
I just think that private landlords are getting away with a lot in this country.
Let me ask you the most annoying question in the world. Why don't you move back in with your mother? And I'm asking that with a tongue in cheek, okay? Because I know you did at one stage. But where are you at with that? With that question,
I mean,
let alone...
Yeah, hello, I can just say hello to my mom.
Yeah, of course, good morning.
She's listening going, please don't move back. Yeah. I don't want to know. I mean, we are turning ourselves into an Irish version of Grey Gardens for sure when we live together. So, I mean, I could charge money for that. But No, I mean, I just think, you know, she's great and I love her and she's always there for me. She supports me 100%. But at the same time, as you're heading into, you're looking into the, you know, business and your whatever 30s into your 40s, you don't want that. You want, you know, to have the your own life. You don't want to have your own space and I know that she is always there, but at the same time, it would be nice to have the same quality of life as a couple does.
Why wouldn't you? Okay, let's get a flavour of the enormous response, Jen, because like, let's face it, it's such a topic. I mean, when you bring this up, you're probably blue in the face talking about it now, but I presume that whatever company you keep, everyone has kind of, I'm not mad about the expression, but skin in the game. People who own a house, want a house, live in a house, rent a house, renting out a house. You probably get a great response when you're having a beer with somebody.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, it's a huge, huge topic. Like, when it would have been, you know, just talking about whatever you saw in the cinema the other day. Now it's like the panic about where you're living or what your living situation is, you know?
Okay, let's take a flavour of what the good people listening in. I'm a single person who is trying to buy in the most affordable county in Ireland, Longford. And I keep getting outbid on properties. No new properties have been built there since 2006. The supply is incredibly low. New estates are being built in Kildare and Meath, but nothing in the Midlands. So frustrating, as I've spent the last 3 years saving for a home. I just want to start my life. I'm 30 now and I have no chance of getting a property or even thinking of having a family right now. Now, Jen, if you think you have trouble in Dublin, imagine the frustration in Longford. But let's keep going. We were doing our taxes last night. There's another. We totted up that we've paid €260,000 in rent in 10 years. A normal house, Dublin 8. Our friend in Spain thinks Ireland is a joke regarding how we pay everyone else's mortgages. No hope of a mortgage here. Anne says, with society opening up, time to look at those businesses who won't open due to the greedy landlords. Some of them who charged full rent all through the lockdown. Well, that's be that on their heads. Totally identify with Jen here, says another from Kat. I'm a writer. I work part-time. I'm 42, two sons, and technically 3 weeks away from being homeless. I'm packing as we speak with nowhere to go. The rental market is utterly dysfunctional. Affordable housing doesn't exist, and banks are not interested in single people applying for a mortgage. I'm tempted to find an old bachelor with road frontage and or win the lotto, because otherwise I can't do it. The governing class, the security of your own home as a luxury rather than a necessity. Don't even start me about coastal areas and holiday lets. I know that I wholeheartedly agree with Jen. Single people are like pariahs trying to buy any property. Another, it has never been easy for a single person to buy a house in central Dublin. Even those of us couples who bought years ago had to go outside the city and head towards Lucan and Swords. Many of the older generation only managed to own their home because they lived with their parents. I'm still living with my mother-in-law 26 years after marrying her son, but I will inherit the house. We couldn't afford the house otherwise. It's quite a commitment, isn't it? Listening to Jen, I totally agree. I'm in a holiday home on a short-term let, as it's all I could find close to schools. I'm out on the 29th and right now I've nowhere to move to. That's quite bleak, Jen.
It is. And like the other thing is, like, you do worry about being, you know, you reach a stage where you're possibly too old then to get the 30-year mortgage then.
Too single, too old, too impecunious.
That's it. And as somebody said, it does feel like a house is a luxury that single people will never be able to afford.
Damien was on to say, I fully agree with Jen and supporter regarding the discussion. The embarrassingly inflated prices of houses in parts of this country are vomit-inducing and yet again portray us internationally as the shower of nouveau riche fools. Steady now, Damien. Full of entitlement and notions. Anyway, anyone rather who can't see the origin of this in our historical legacy needs to get their history books out, and we as a people need to get over our disgusting sense of self-importance and entitlement and get our priorities right and our heads out of the clouds. Okay, the housing crisis is truly appalling. However, there appears to be a snobbishness about where people are wanting to buy. There are a significant number of homes available in the Greater Dublin area for less than €350,000. People are just too snobbish about that postal code. Jen.
I'm not snobbish about any buzz about that much right now. As a happy ring sender here, I can tell you we had a stigma for a good chunk of the 80s and 90s about being undesirable. And look at us now, we're like Google Central. So no area in Dublin is undesirable, put it that way.
Well, Ringsend is another league altogether now.
Yeah, it really is.
You couldn't be possibly in the zone there.
No, I mean, that's the thing. I grew up like with a working class family in the 1980s and alongside all other working class families like in Ringsend and Stetlocks, that's decimated now. There's no communities, really. They're gone. And they're gone for families. They're gone for single people. Like, and the thing about single people is it feels like you're not a member, like a viable member of society, or it's somebody that the government even thinks is worth thinking about. It's just all geared towards families, you know, and it's like what you want to promise, you just want us to work and then just die or disappear or because you don't have children.
What's the dream scenario for you, Jen?
Apart from, you know, Roman Roy coming in on his helicopter.
I'm afraid so. Swooping you up and heading out. You don't want to be part of that family. Come on, let's face it.
I know. For the clothes alone, maybe.
Okay. Well, we'll get you a few turtlenecks and send them to you in the post. And see what we'll ask Shiv if she can help us out here. But in the meantime, what are we going to do? I mean, imagine you were addressing the Minister for Housing this morning. What would you say to him?
I would just say, like, just give us some dignity. That's what we're looking for. We want a seat at the table to be able to discuss how we've been, you know, earning money, paying our taxes and not getting anything for it. All we're just hamsters on a wheel trying to, like, pay our rent and keep up with the bills and everything else. And that's just not something that we can do anymore. I think a lot of people are at breaking point and that's just what we want. We want to be seen and heard and have these discussions.
Jen, you've started a big discussion here, so thank you for that. I appreciate your time this morning, and go and call your mother, apologise, and we'll talk to you again soon. I hope. I'm only joking. I wish her well. Nice to talk to you, Jen. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Good luck with everything. Jen Gannon there, and she's really started the ball rolling because it's an enormous response that we'll get to as much as we can throughout the morning, and I suspect for the rest of the week. Let me say good morning to you, Ken Healy. How are you today, Ken?
How are you, Owen? How are things?
I'm great, thank you. It's nice of you to be on the show with us today. Wednesday the 12th of May, a significant day, as you told me.
Yeah, it's International Nurses Day, Ryan.
I didn't know that the nurses had an international day like today.
Well,
so
apparently it's the birthday for Florence Nightingale. It's Florence Nightingale's birthday.
Okay, well, let me say happy International Nurses Day to all the nursing staff listening in around the world, and particularly on this island today, because as you well know, Ken, now more than ever, the nurses need to be given the love and gratitude of the nation.
Well, this is it, Ryan. Exactly, and they've been very busy for the last while. It's been something on.
I read something about it in a paper somewhere. But why your interest in this day?
Well, my mum was a nurse, Ryan. She would have trained in St. Michael's in Dunleary in the late 50s.
Yeah.
Great hospital, as you know.
Yes, indeed. I know well. Pass it by regularly.
During her training, she would have done great things like spiking the doctor's tea with the magnesium sulfate, apparently.
Okay. A messer.
A bit of a messer, yeah.
Good.
One of the doctors would have been well known to you at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, apparently Pat Tuberty was one of the doctors
That's my father you were speaking about before he headed to John of God's as a working man as opposed to a patient. But not that there's anything wrong with the patient. But the point being that if your mother was spiking my father's tea, well, he was a coffee man.
It's a while ago. Anyway, in the early 60s, my mum got involved with a charitable organisation and went to Vietnam in 1963.
Whoa, what a time to go to Vietnam.
Exactly. So she was about nearly 2 years in Vietnam, working. She went over to set up a leprosarium initially, but obviously got involved a lot with the situation in Vietnam. The government, the South Vietnamese, it would seem, the government at the time asked her to go to a place called Quy Nhon, which would have been north of Saigon.
It was the war kind of raging around.
The war
her.
Was on at the time. Yeah,
it wouldn't have been
as well known in the early 60s. Americans got more and more involved, and as the 60s went on, so it got the news came back more and more about what was going on in Vietnam. Yeah, so it was. It was a tough time. She spent a lot of time there dealing with. She would have dealt with a lot of the refugees coming, fleeing the war. would have been involved in vaccinating a lot of people about from things like typhoid and all sorts of things that we don't really hear about anymore.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah,
exactly. Thank God. She would have set up an operating theatre in Queen Yon and been dealing with injuries and the people. Yeah, so she wasn't involved with the military as such, but because of the war, the military would have been around the place. And I have a picture of her holding a gun, holding a rifle of some sort, because they had to give the nurses all some sort of small weapons training in case they ever had a problem. And I have another picture of her holding this little Vietnamese baby, and on the back of the picture, it has in her handwriting has the baby was delivered by C-section 15 minutes after the mother's death. So the mother had been shot, and a US Army medic managed to deliver the child and save it, and it ended up in the hospital where my mum was working. Yeah. So,
and the Viet Cong played a part in her story too.
Yeah, she was captured at one stage by the Viet Cong. I don't know how long she was in captivity, but she was ultimately released by, or rescued, rescued by the US military, the US forces, herself and a few other similar nurses and other Westerners who would have been rescued.
So Betty goes from spiking doctor's tea in Dunleary to the jungles of Vietnam to be captured by the Viet Cong and rescued by the US Marines, and we're only in 1966.
And she would have been 23 when she went to Vietnam.
What a story.
So, she came back then, obviously, in 65. I'm told she was a guest on the Late Late Show at some point in 65.
Oh, that makes perfect sense, yeah.
Yeah, with Gay Byrne. But it was a previous videotape, apparently, so I don't think there's any record of it. And then she got the Florence Nightingale Medal in 1967.
Yes. And that's for nursing.
For nursing, yeah. So, and up until only a couple of years ago, she would have been the last Irish woman to have received it. It was about 50 years before somebody else got it. So that was 1967. And then in 1969, she was appointed or nominated onto the Irish Commission for Peace and Justice, which was one of these ecclesiastical commissions. I have the minutes from some meeting in Wynn's Hotel in Abbey Street, where the Chief Justice Carole O'Dellig suggested that my mum be the honorary secretary until they get a proper executive secretary appointed. So it's like, that was weird.
Yeah, no doubt.
Not what you expect to see. She was on that commission then, and then in 1972 she got married, so had to give up her job because that's what you had to do in 1972 when you got married. 1973, I was born. Good year, as you know.
A great year, Ken. Actually, probably one of the finest years known to. To
I had the best month as well, Ryan. Believe it or not.
Oh, and the same month. What day in that month, Ken?
I'm a few weeks ahead of you.
Congratulations, happy birthday.
And then a few months later, I stopped breathing and turned blue, and my mum found me in the cot not breathing and picked me up and dumped me in the sink, apparently with the dirty dishes, and saved my life. While one of the neighbours had to run down the road to call an ambulance because there wasn't even a wired phone in the house. The houses were only just built. She would have been involved then in the local parish quite a lot in the early 80s. Got involved with a local women's group to fundraise and hassle the local parish priest until they built a community playgroup, which would have been, the building would have been there until very, very, very recently. Actually, the old port cabin thing was replaced eventually.
Okay.
That was, and then when I went to secondary school, she went back to work in nursing. Would have worked in Monkstown Hospital and Vincent's Private Hospital.
Okay.
And been involved as a theatre nurse there.
Was she good crack as well? She sounds like the sort of woman I'd love to have met.
She was. she was really nice. I mean, we miss her a lot. I didn't get to the bit where she's passed now, but so 10 years ago, we would have lost her. She was a great mum. And I thought it was really only she was diagnosed with a form of dementia, frontotemporal dementia, okay, in the early 2000s. Mm. And we kind of lost her gradually, through that. But they looked after her very well in Trotsky Hospital. And then she passed away pretty much 10 years ago now.
And dementia is such a cruel, cruel.
It was tough, but it's harder on the family, I think. Well, that was the one thing that I kind of took from it, was that she wasn't aware. Certainly, in the later part, she wasn't aware of her own condition as much.
Yeah.
So in the early stages, she would have been, she would have, been saying the wrong words, and then she'd say, "Oh God, I can't believe I said that." And that was the early stages of it.
Yes.
But as it progresses, the patient, well, that was what we were told. Anyway, the patient loses that level of awareness of what's wrong. I guess that it's not easy for the family.
No. And so she wasn't a distressed patient as such. But it was distressing for you as a family to see this amazing powerhouse.
Yeah, exactly. Descend. And she'd done so much. I guess that the one thing the one thing that I took from it was that they looked after her so well that, it was sort of a giving back a little bit.
Okay. Yeah.
So the things that she had done. But to have some of the records, I have a whole pile of her letters that she wrote back from Vietnam at the time.
Oh, wonderful.
That she would have wrote back to my aunts, who obviously were in Dublin. And, things like, the shelling was very heavy last night.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So you kind of think, you kind of read these things and go, well, I've no idea what that's about.
Yeah,
of course. And another story that you would have mentioned in passing about having to do an emergency tracheotomy on some patients because there was no doctor around, so she was the only person
there. She had to step up to the plate.
Yeah, and then later in life, in the theatre in one of the hospitals in Dublin, and the surgeon was called out for some emergency, and he just looked at mum and said, "Betty, you close," and left the theatre. And from then on, the anaesthetist called her Mrs. Healy. She finished up the surgery.
Wow.
So you hear stories like that, and you kind of go, "Okay."
Yeah.
For me, it was that she was just mum, and she went to work and was a nurse when I was in school, and then made the dinner and stuff like that.
Yeah, of course. But she
made us tidy up the toys.
But she was a closet heroine,
This is it. Yeah, a real sort of, that's. I'm even struggling to think if I left something out now.
No, I'm sure you have. But it's like, it reminds me of the gangster granny, that David Walliams story, where she seems so innocent, but actually she's quite a piece of work.
Yeah. And to go, like you said, to go from playing pranks and Michael's to being at the same table as the Chief Justice and the chairperson of the Central Bank, there was T.K. Whittaker at the time, was there.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And then, effectively, not really. She never really looked for any particular praise about it or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm delighted. I'm delighted you got in touch today, Ken.
I really appreciate the time.
No, because you're not at all. It's our pleasure, because your mother and her legacy today represents all the wonderful nurses in this country, and they might have seen some serious cases and action and stories in their day. They might be retired now with grandchildren going, "So what did you do when you were younger?" We're all complicated novels, as I keep saying.
Makes you feel a bit inadequate, all right.
It'd be good to talk to you, and belated happy birthday. You're not getting any younger,
No. Thanks very much.
Mind yourself, Ken. No, real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you. It's lovely to remember Betty Kenny, who, I just thought it was a fascinating insight to that woman's life and story, and I appreciate Ken coming on to say that. At 9:27, let me say good morning. Miles Dungan, good to talk to you, Miles.
Good morning, Mr. Tuberty. I remember doing horrible things to you in the 1990s. I hope it's forgiven. You're not going to give me a hard time.
You're referring to, I suspect, where you made me go in at the deep end to become a stand-up comedian, an auctioneer, a hairdresser, an opera singer, and...
Stuntman. Don't forget the stuntman.
Stuntman. Remember that lovely man, Martin Grace from Kilkenny, threw me down the steps of the radio centre and you...
And made you put your fist through a window and I think
and
set
you
on
fire. Exactly. Yeah. And you were there saying, can
it
I have a go?
Oh, I was there every bit of the way and I watched your discomfort and thoroughly enjoyed it, which is why I have great fear
today
about what you're going to do to me today.
You should. And also that when you insisted on having a go at throwing me down the steps, putting me on fire and putting me through a window, I thought, they've stopped recording this. You know, it was just your anger got the better of you. Miles, you're back with this book, Four Killings, Land, Hunger, Murder and Family in the Irish Revolution. Why I love this book is because, talking to you this morning, there are very few people listening, Miles, as you well know, who don't have a great-grandfather or an actual grandfather or somebody in their family who didn't have some connection with either the War of Independence or, broadly speaking, the land. And when we think about this week, Miles, about property and how housing is still the big issue in 2021. If you could imagine 100 years ago, go back to the agrarian struggle before that again, back to the famine before that again. This country, the land, every blade of grass and stone extracted from the soil, it's visceral, isn't it?
Absolutely visceral. And, I mean, you talk about closeness of connections. One of the people who was incredibly helpful with me or for me on this book was my cousin Joe McKenna. Mm. One of those weird, another of those weird Irish anomalies. Joe is about 5 years younger than me, but he's my mother's generation. So there are many, many references in the book to his father, John McKenna. So that's how close, in many cases, we still are to the war. Even though it's 100 years ago, we're still that close. But as far as the land is concerned, because what you're getting at here is this book is about the War of Independence.
Yes.
And it's about my extended family and murder and killing and executions in the War of Independence. But it starts in Arizona, and it starts with a land dispute involving another member of the family in Arizona who would not have been there in the first place had it not been for the land situation in the 1880s and 1890s in Ireland. And then that's the first killing. And then the second killing is of his nephew, Mark Clinton. The man in Arizona is Jack Clinton. Mark Clinton is then murdered. He's an IRA volunteer and he's killed in May 1920, but not by the RIC, not by the Black and Tans, not by the dreaded Oxies, but by local people who are seizing land. And this is something that went on during the War of Independence, before it and after it, in actual fact, and particularly during the Civil War, but had been going on for the better part of 20 years in Ireland and hasn't really grabbed the attention, I think, as much, for obvious reasons. Mm. But as you say, it is utterly visceral. I mean, the irony is in all of this that Head of Zeus, or the publishers of this book, have now asked me to go on and write, and I'm working on it at the moment, writing a blockbuster about the land struggle in Ireland over a period of about 200 years. So that should keep me going now, keep me off the streets for
a
while.
For sure. But the, even throughout the book, Land League, Land War, Land Grabbers, Land. It's this central thread running through the whole story.
Mm. And don't forget, 1906 to 1909, a little war that people often ignore, the Ranch Wars. Because what was happening was the landlords weren't all gone. I mean, there were still some of them left. There were still some of them hanging on. Mm. They didn't hang on for much longer after the Free State was set up. But they had basically been replaced. They had been replaced by a fairly rich landowning Catholic middle class. And these, by and large, were what they called the graziers or the ranchers. And this was a period where you had a movement. And this had been going on for the better part of 50 years, but it's accentuated at the beginning of the 20th century. Mm. A movement from tillage to pasture as population declined and as there were fewer people and a little bit more land became available, what you got was this kind of rural agricultural middle class buying up land, and instead of planting crops, they were putting cattle and they were putting sheep onto this land, and then these were being exported to markets in Britain. And that meant that you had an underclass of small farmers and landless labourers who had no chance whatever of acquiring land of their own and acquiring their own 20 acres or whatever the minimum was to keep themselves going. And there, you know, you read diatribes being written about this waste of land, and particularly in the part of the country where I live, which is County Meath, this wastage of land, all this land and all you've got is completely devastated because it's just got cattle on it. It's got grass and cattle. No crops are growing. You know, I mean, it sounds a little bit strange and a bit anomalous to us nowadays to some extent, because we really are, you know, we're very much into our pasture rather than our tillage. But that was not the case at the beginning of the 20th century.
Of course, you know, if you again, rhyming history with what you're saying, no part of society, there is a part of society who had no chance whatever, to use your own words, to own a house, to own property. It's all back to this.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about, again, everyone, well, most people in Ireland have we call it in our family, there's always an archivist within the family. It's not me, funny enough, in my family, it's my brother, one of my brothers, but who have a good brain for figures and stories and, you know, the way history gets muddled in the passing of time, where you go, do you remember that time you did that? You go, he didn't do it, she did it. You go, oh, right, okay. So this brings us to your maternal grandmother, who played such a central part of it. And in fact, as I was reading about her, Mary Teresa McKenna, or May McKenna, she was probably, you know, her interest in life. I could see her in another world as a presenter of 5-7 Live, you know, once upon a time, as it was before drive time and so on. You know what I mean? She swallowed the papers, even the sports section. She was definitely, the gene traveled well, Miles.
Well, I mean, she was the reason I ended up as presenter of 5-7 Live and quite a few other things, there's no doubt about it, because she was a huge influence on me, because she spent a lot of time. She had plenty of time to spend, and she had this kind of mophead young grandson, and she would spend quite a bit of time, but she'd spend a month in the summertime, and then she'd spend, you know, a couple of weeks at other times of the year, and we'd go visit her, and she would babysit me a lot. She would look after me when my mother or father were doing stuff, and there were lots of walks in and around the area of the Park Hotel in Virginia, which was, I think, once a Lord Hedford's hunting lodge, and it's now a hotel. But and she would tell me stories, and she would tell me stories about, and she would talk to me about things, and she would get me interested. She got me interested in, you know, I was a nerd. I was a nerd long before you were a nerd. you know, she got me interested in politics when I was, God help us, about 9 or 10 years old.
Yes.
And you know, she, I remember as a very small kid, one of my earliest memories as a very small kid is of being woken up by my grandmother to go and witness the inauguration of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, for example.
Yes.
That's the kind of level that we're dealing with here.
Yes.
And she was a repository, there's no doubt about it. She had great stories, but she also had secrets. And what one of the things in the introduction to the book, I talk about my relationship with my grandmother, and she had no problem telling me stories of being rousted out by the Black and Tans in, you know, 1920, 1921, and worried about the house being burnt to the ground because that had happened to other people and all this kind of stuff. And I, of course, I swallowed this, and I developed what a lot of people do at that age, a visceral hatred of our neighbours, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Now, I've managed to get over that, thankfully.
Yes.
Not totally. You know, I still, you know, in a penalty shootout between England and Germany, I know who I support. Anyway, so, you know, I was getting all this on her knee almost. And I swallowed it, and I thought, this is fascinating stuff. My God, those Black and Tans were horrible, and those people she calls the Uggsies, whatever that means, they were horrible as well. And then when I got older and I got into learning history and studying history, I began to doubt. I kind of thought, oh, for God's sake, why would the Black and Tans be interested in my genteel grandmother? I knew that she had a brother, Justin McKenna, from Kells, or lived in Kells, from Mullagh originally, but lived in Kells, who was a TD. He was in the second Dáil. He voted on the treaty. He voted in favour of the treaty. That everybody knew, because my mother was, you know, was very happy to talk about him. My grandmother was always very happy to talk about him. And I knew My two granduncles, her other brothers, Rafe McKenna and John McKenna, both from Mullagh. Well, what she never told me was that they had been in the IRA. And this I had to discover for myself. Another cousin, Erna McKenna, is a solicitor in London. She told me about the involvement of three of my grandmother's brothers, T.P., Rafe and John McKenna, in the IRA. And so I just got interested in it. And then when the pensions collections, when they got up to the period of the War of Independence, the first draft of pensions collections that were put online, our pensions files that were put online was from 1916. And then the next draft was from the War of Independence. So I just, I'd check out and see if any of them are up there. And one of the brothers, T.P. McKenna, the youngest, who died tragically of TB in Argentina at the age of 26, his was up there. And I went through it. And that's when I had this light bulb moment where I came across a line in his pension file in which it was stated that he had, quote unquote, executed an informer in Carlinstown. And that started me off.
And now we're in. I mean, it's so intriguing, the genesis of the project, because you described the military pensions archive, which was a massive resource, of course, for you and so many. If people haven't read them, they are so intriguing because you can just nerd out for the day if you want. Because no, but you know what I mean? People had to kind of almost write an essay about their experiences and document what action they had seen during the War of Independence. So if you can imagine reading them, it's almost like I don't mean to trivialise it, but it's like almost like a vox pop. Among the ordinary soldiers of volunteers, whatever you want to call them of the time, in their own words, it's like brushing shoulders with ghosts, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, you've got two different sets of documents. You have this wonderful collection of Bureau of Military History witness statements, which are beautifully typed out. And, you know, you can word search an individual word and it's made very, very easy for you. The problem with those are that they're fascinating. They're wonderful and they're so colourful and they really get across the period, the energy of the period and the danger of the period. But the problem is that when the 1,700 or so people who were interviewed were giving their statements, they knew these weren't going to appear until after they died. Mm. So two things happen. One, they big themselves up. Mm. How I won the War of Independence, right, number one. Yes. And the other thing is they settle scores, because there could be somebody in the locality who took the Republican side, for example, in the Civil War, and they want to demean or diminish their role in the War of Independence, so they do that. So they're great fun, they're fantastic, and I urge anybody to go and read them, but they're a little bit unreliable.
Yes.
The pensions collection is different because everything has to be verified. You've got to have three senior IRA officers validating everything you say. And then subsequently, there are these brigade activity reports, which are also online. Militaryarchives.ie, folks, the greatest resource in addition to the census. Thank you, Katrina Crowe and Daniel Iosis in Military Archives and Cecile Gordon and people like that. Mm-hmm. They're absolutely fantastic. But the pension files are more credible because they've got to be verified. Brigade activity reports come later where, you know, the local commandants are asked, right, we want you to detail every action that your brigade was involved in and name every person who was involved in it. And that's where you get down to the nitty-gritty.
Which we need to do now, because your book is called Four Killings. So let's just keep it straight and go through the four killings. I mean, the idea that the book begins, or at least the first killing begins, it takes us to Arizona. Already has you can smell the sand and the dust and the sweat off the pages.
Yeah, I mean, I came by this completely by accident. I had two helpers on the Clinton side, Mark Clintons, one archaeologist in Hoth, who used to be the manager of Intuanua, the lucky man, got to know Leslie Dowdle very well, mm-hmm. and then the other was a Mark Clinton in Sutton Coldfield. that Mark Clint and I corresponded with a lot. And in a footnote, believe it or not, talk about burying the lead, Ryan. In a footnote, he mentioned, by the way, you might be interested in the fact that your cousin Jack Clinton was murdered in Arizona in 1915.
Amazing. Wow.
Now, it's all still involved with land because Jack Clinton was a small homesteader in Arizona. And he got up the nose of a big cattle company because things were changing in the American West. And all of this free federal land that had been used by these big cattle companies to graze their cattle for nothing was being bought up by homesteaders. They were getting in the way. They were nuisances. They were putting up fences. And there was a dispute. There were a number of disputes, but there was a particular dispute between Jack Clinton and a couple of the cowboys who worked for this big, it was actually a California-based company, and two of them had threatened to kill him. And then one day in June 1915, they arrived at his ranch. They insisted that he come out to talk to them, and one of them, in cold blood, he was completely unarmed, he was wearing moccasins, for God's sake, and they put four bullets into him and killed him. And that's the first story that I tell of the ramifications of that, the lead up to that and the ramifications of that. And so we start in Arizona, yeah.
And his daughter lived to a good age.
His daughter lived into the 2000s.
Amazing.
She only died in 2000. Mm. And I mean, I've had a lot of contact with two of his granddaughters, for example, who've been invaluable in sending me photographs and supplying me with information and all that kind of stuff. So they were great.
Oh, so, I mean, I know you love the Wild West and the I mean, it is. It's just endlessly interesting, isn't it? But that's for another day. We'll come back to that. Killing number two, Miles.
Yeah, killing number two is Jack Clinton's nephew, Mark Clinton. And Mark Clinton was a farmer's son who was a member of the IRA in County Meath, right on the border with Cavan in a place called Cormeen. And here's where the land thing comes in, because there was a dispute over a parcel of land that was owned by a cousin of the Clintons, a man called Smith. Now, Smith is one of these people who is rising up through the, through the social ranks. He owns this farm, but he also owns a farm on the far side of Kells in a place called Kilmainham Wood, and that's where he lives. So he rents out this farm on what they call the 11-month system. And local people, certain local people who, in fairness, have nothing or very, very little, decide this man's got too much. So they say, right, we are seizing this, because this was something that was happening all over Meath. It was happening in West Meath. It was happening in Roscommon. It was in this sort of area of Connacht and North Leinster where there wasn't an awful lot going on in the actual War of Independence. Now, which was the cart and which was the horse, we could debate. Sure. So anyway, long story short, they say, we are taking this land. Smith goes to the Clintons and says, look, will you back me up here? Will you support me? The Clintons say, yeah. Peter Clinton, who was a brother of Mark Clinton and father of the Mark Clinton that I talked about in Sutton Coldfield, goes into the field to plough the field, is shot at, is hit, is wounded. A couple of days later, his brother Mark Clinton goes into the field. And his father, a few hours after he goes into the field, his father finds two dead plough horses and Mark Clinton dying. And he has been murdered by a group of about five people who are about half the gang, this particular gang. They were known locally as the Black Hand Gang. So that's killing number two. Killing number three then arises out of killing number
two. Keep going. I'm fascinated.
Yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah, no, you're on a roll. It's great.
I'm on a roll. Okay, so this gang has been doing a lot of pretty horrendous and pretty nasty stuff. They have shot at people. They have blown up people's houses in order to seize land. And the IRA have actually done very little about it. And the RIC have done absolutely nothing about it because the RIC has disappeared from these parts of rural Ireland, all over rural Ireland. They have completely disappeared and they have retrenched into the towns. So, the countryside, therefore, it's open season in the countryside. And in general, the IRA do a very good job of maintaining law and order and discipline. But in this case, they don't. After Mark Clinton is killed, that's different. This guy is an IRA volunteer. This is a direct you know, an affront to the IRA. So the commanding officer of the IRA in Meath, who is Sean Boylan, if you are familiar with the name, it's because he's the dad of our greatest and our beloved football manager here, 23 years in charge of one of the great teams before that, Sherwin in light blue came along. Anyway, enough of that bitterness. So Sean Boylan Sr. Takes this on board.
Wow.
Takes it very, very seriously and does not stop until he has rounded up all of the members of this gang, bar one. He doesn't get the guy who actually shot Mark Clinton dead. He is, quote-unquote, lifted by the RIC on fairly spurious charges. Now, I have no personal, I can't prove it, but I have no doubt that he was in cahoots with the RIC and that the RIC became aware that this was going to happen through a spy in the Meath IRA brigade, and they got to this guy. His name was William Gordon, a Presbyterian from a place near Bailaborough in County Cavan, and they lifted him and they, quote-unquote, arrested him. They threw him into Mountjoy, where I suspect he was used to spy on other IRA inmates of the Joy. So then Billy Gordon is brought back to Navan. He's put on trial and he is acquitted. However, Boylan has been keeping an eye on this, and Boylan has a collaborator in the Meath Chronicle, a man called Hayes, who I presume is probably a relative of the great Meath footballer. I'm sorry for banging on about Meath football.
I sense pride in your voice. It's okay. Nothing wrong with that.
Who was also a distinguished journalist.
Yes.
So Hayes tips off Boylan that this guy is in Navan, has been acquitted, has basically been given a wad of money and has been taken by the RIC to go to the railway station and to get the hell out. However, he stops short of the railway station and he goes to a pub which is still there in Navan called the Flat House Pub. Boylan gets wind of this, goes into the Flat House Pub in person with a rusty old revolver, sticks up the two RIC men, tells them not to move for at least an hour, lifts Gordon. Gordon is then brought to Dunboyne, which is the bailiwick of Boylan, is put on trial twice by the IRA. The only civilian to be executed by the IRA, not for being a spy, informer or robber, but for being a murderer. He's put on trial the first time, he's convicted. Boylan goes to Michael Collins, says, what are we going to do with this? Collins brings us to the cabinet. The Countess Markievicz and Ernest Blythe demur. Collins goes back to Boylan, says, try him again. He's tried again. Again, he's found guilty. A very interesting Presbyterian clergyman from Antrim, a man called James Hamilton Irwin, is brought down to, you know, to do the last rites thing. Irwin tries to persuade Boylan to let him go into Irwin's custody, and Irwin says, I'll put him on a boat to America. Boylan says, no, this guy is going to come back and he's going to be the death of us all. And Boylan goes back to Collins. What do we do? Collins says, do what you want. And Boylan is involved directly in the execution of William Gordon. So that's killing number three.
Okay, and then I have to go brief for the fourth, if you don't mind. So killing four, to complete the quartet, the rather bloody quartet.
Yeah, I mean, killing number four is a young guy called Patrick Keelan, who falls out with his employer, informs on his employer. His employer is lifted by the army. And the IRA then lift this guy, this young guy, Keelan. They take him, they interrogate him, they probably, you know, rough him up a little bit, and they release him and they warn him, you be a good boy. He's not a good boy. He goes straight to the Black and Tans, and for the next 3 months he goes around Meath with the Black and Tans as what they call an identifier. He's identifying targets for the Black and Tans. He makes the mistake of missing his mammy. He goes home one night. The IRA find out about it within a matter of hours, and they lift him again. They put him on trial. They court-martial him, and they execute him. Now, what's that got to do with my extended family? What I've discovered from the military pension files is that my granduncles T.P. McKenna and John McKenna are involved in the execution, and that Peter Clinton, who already mentioned, who was wounded in that field the previous year, is also involved in the execution, and John McKenna is specifically involved. He's in the firing squad. That's mentioned in his pension file, which is online. Anybody can see it. So that's killing number four. That takes place outside Manolty in a place called Garryard Wood, which I still find very mysterious, because Keelan is left there for about 2 years and is then disinterred, and is brought, I'm 90% certain, brought to the McKenna family plot, where a twin brother and sister of mine are also buried. They died as children many years ago, and is reinterred in that plot.
It's just so fascinating, and congratulations on the book, Miles, because it brings to life, as a microcosm of an Irish family, all of these, as I say, bloody trials and tribulations that define the country. But you've done it with, as usual, the class and aplomb we're so accustomed to. Miles, thank you for your time this morning.
My pleasure, Ryan.
And I hope we'll be alive and well in Kells soon for the book festival that you
run. Indeed. When are you coming back to Hinterland?
When I'm invited.
All right. Well, you're always invited.
Oh, no, that's a given.
Are you working on a book at the moment?
Not as we speak, but there's something bubbling away somewhere in the back of my brain.
Good. Get busy.
Okay, you're right. You're not the first person to say that to me this week. Okay, Miles. Have a great day. Miles, thanks as always. Great
Cheers
to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
That's Miles Dunga, one of my favourite people. And his book is called Four Killings, Land Hunger, Murder and Family in the Irish Revolution. And like I said, look, you just heard what he said. It is fascinating.